This is episode 10 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to the 17th episode of the Software Freedom Law Show.
People are going to think that this is the 10th episode, but they're going to think wrong.
Well, actually, this is kind of funny because it reminds me of my t-shirt that I bought from Thinky.
But your t-shirt only works written. You can't say out loud. You can't explain it on the air.
Well, you can say there are only 10 people in the world.
But that doesn't make any sense.
Oh, I guess you're
because,
right.
Because the whole point is people read it and they read 10.
Yes, but it's really
10 because there's people who understand binary and people who don't. But see, none of this works. So we'll put the link to the t-shirt in the show notes and people can read it and then they'll understand that there are only 10 people in the world.
Except they might still be confused about which number episode this is.
Well, because it's not the second episode because we don't number in binary.
We don't number in binary and we don't number in base 10 either.
Or base 8 for that matter. Because there's this progression of base numbering systems. Of course, we needed binary because that's what computers understand. Uh-huh. And then octal was a way of writing binary numbers short. And then when we got more bits on computers, we had to go to hex to write octal short. But see, it's all a power of 2. Therefore, you can convert from binary to octal to hex very easily.
Well, I just wonder if it's going to be confusing. But
what's going to be confusing? That we don't use base 10?
Well, just I think it maybe hasn't been confusing until now, but
now that we're in episode 10.
10.
Which is the 17th episode. Because it's not only a lot of episodes. It's a lot of episodes. Okay. But we're in double digits now. But we had to get this 17th episode to get to double digits, because not only are we numbering in hex, but we also numbered starting with 0.
That's correct.
So we're 0-based hex-numbered podcast. We're the only 0-based hex-numbered podcast on the entire internet.
I really hope that's not our only claim to fame.
It is a claim,
and I'm proud of it.
Yeah, it's good. So we have an exciting discussion, an exciting guest.
We do.
Our first double-digited episode.
It's true, and I have been vindicated, because at least one of our listeners enjoys having teasers of who the guest is going to be.
Yeah, he set up a quite complicated scenario in his email. So he actually sent this, it actually wasn't a question, it was a comment in after our last show where we took actual questions. It was after that one that he sent an email and said, oh, well, actually, I like the guest teaser because he downloads it with G-Potter or some other podcast catching software. So he doesn't look at it there. It happens automatically. Then he puts it on his device and then he gets in his car and plays it in his car. So he never sees the screen, which is good. We're glad that he's not looking at the screen to see who the guest is while driving. But that I would have thought would have vindicated me, because he would say, well, we should tell him early so he's not tempted to look at the screen, because we don't want the guy looking at the screen while he's driving.
That's definitely true.
But it turns out he likes the suspense because he doesn't know.
Well, it becomes an overall listening experience.
An overall listening experience.
And he may not have a screen. Well, I don't know if he has.
That's
a screen
some sort of sales pitch. Listening experience on the Software Freedom Law Show.
If we're not going to sell our podcast, who is?
I don't know. They sell it pretty well on Identica. You know, we'll let the masses. We're crowdsourced.
There are masses.
We have crowdsourced marketing of our podcast. We've crowdsourced that.
But anyway, I think we have a distorted view of how, or not a distorted view, but we have a different view of how people listen to podcasts, because we're New Yorkers and we take public transportation and we're not driving.
Yeah, everybody should take public transportation.
It's not practical everywhere.
I know. I have this argument with my wife a lot.
Anyway, well, we do have an exciting guest, and I won't say what his name is.
But I think before we get to the interview, there's a lot of concepts that our guest is going to talk about that I think we have to help our listeners understand, because they're complex things that we haven't actually talked about before in the podcast.
Yep, and I think many of you who are familiar with this area will guess who it is before we even get to the segment of the interview.
Yeah, you did way too much setup on this suspense thing. But the first thing we want to talk about is remember back at a time when free software was younger and the whole software industry was younger, and in the United States we actually tried to stop Microsoft. Our government actually tried and failed to stop Microsoft, mainly because they weren't very good at it.
And this is, and what Bradley is talking about is the is antitrust law.
Specifically, the antitrust case against Microsoft, mm-hmm. which originally stemmed from a variety of different claims that people had. There was the issue of the browser being tied too closely to the operating system and Microsoft's control of protocols and the desktop mm-hmm. market and so forth. And ironically, used GNU/Linux systems as a defense, saying that, mm-hmm. oh, these exist because they're this tiny percent of the market share. Therefore, we're not violating antitrust law.
But the outcome was actually different in Europe. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're done talking about the U.S., but the same similar cases were brought in Europe, but a lot more successfully, right. even though defenses were raised.
Right. Wait, we should remind people that the U.S. case didn't get us really anything we wanted. There was both the federal mm-hmm. case and the attorneys general, various states and commonwealths brought cases, and they failed to actually get things we need. It's very simple things. One of the things that still bugs me is you can't buy a blank computer. You can't mm-hmm. go buy a computer that has no operating system on it. And that's something that I wish my government would do something about.
Yeah, and it's tough to find a computer that doesn't have Windows on it.
Correct.
Although, you know, there are a lot of the
netbooks.
The Dells.
Yeah, there is the regular Dell models. But yeah. Really, if you want to buy pre-installed GNU plus Linux, mm-hmm. There are very few choices for you, mm-hmm. mostly in the netbook market. And if you want just a blank computer, say I don't even want anything pre-installed. I want to buy a blank computer,
right.
empty,
right.
with nothing, just bare hardware, and do it myself. Right. And I can't do that without, unless you build it yourself. I guess if you construct your own computer. But it's hard to do for a laptop, for example, to construct your own laptop from off-the-shelf components that you can buy.
Yeah. No, I mean, now the laws don't prevent, the laws don't force anyone to sell blank laptops, but what they do prevent is unfair competition.
Correct. And I think, in my personal opinion, as a non-lawyer, mm-hmm. that Microsoft's backroom deals effectively with many computer manufacturers mm-hmm. Is unfair. And these are the types of things we had hoped that would happen in the antitrust case get resolved in mm-hmm. the U.S. And pretty much none of them did. And of course, that's not the only issue. There's the issue of Microsoft's control of protocols, file sharing protocols, their control of standards in various different ways. And mm-hmm. really, in the U.S., none of this got solved in the way that we would want. But fortunately,
It's a different case in Europe.
Yeah. And I think the fundamental difference, I think, is that there is this multi-country wide system in Europe to bring something like this. As many people in the U.S. Are hopefully aware by now, and certainly everyone in Europe is, there is this thing called the European Union, and there's a thing called the European Commission, which is, I guess, effectively the executive mm-hmm. branch of Europe, of the European government.
I think that's right. I mean, a lot of people make analogies to sort of the member states of the European Union being analogous to states in the United States. And there's a lot to be said for that analogy, but the way that the bodies function is quite different. And in this particular instance, it resulted in a very different result.
Right, and the European Commission was able to bring an antitrust case against Microsoft, correct? Mm-hmm. And actually, it was possible for people in the free software world to bring evidence to that.
Right, to actually participate in the hearing.
Right, which we couldn't do in the U.S. That wasn't possible for Richard Stallman to get mm-hmm. on the stand to say that freedom was being.
Well, we do. I mean, we do have you know, amicus briefs, and we do have ways for third parties to get involved in litigation.
But it's not the same as being really, truly involved in the way that mm-hmm. I think was possible this time, at least in the EU.
Well, I think that what's great is that, you know, is that our guest coming up in the next segment, which is our interview, that our guest has been involved throughout almost the entire proceeding in the EU.
Right, and when proceeding that, the thing I think is very similar between Europe and the U.S. is that there's this constant level of bureaucracy that mm-hmm. you face when you're dealing with litigation of any kind, mm-hmm. Including this type. And so there's arguments and counter-arguments. Microsoft lists a variety of defenses and says there's all these reasons that we're not committing mm-hmm. Anti-competitive actions because of various things, including referencing free software
right.
and saying that free software is a defense for them because it exists.
Right, right. Just as was asserted in the U.S. case, but much more effectively in the European Union.
Well, in some ways more effective, in some ways not, because we actually were able to get some good results, which we weren't able to get in the U.S., I think.
Oh, yeah. You know, actually, I'm sorry. I actually misspoke. But you know what I meant.
Yeah. Well, what you meant was that despite the fact that they raised free software
much
as a defense,
less effectively,
right? In the U.S., maybe it works. I don't know if the free software was the main issue. I think mostly in the U.S. that we're just basically afraid to confront big corporations. I think that's more the reason, but that's my personal opinion. But in the EU, they raised these same type of arguments about how free software is a defense. Yet this was not accepted by the European courts, and they said that actually Microsoft had to change some behaviors and actually implement some things to help free software be able to compete more effectively with the proprietary alternatives from Microsoft. And that's just such an amazing process. And I'm so glad that we have a guest who's been involved in this whole thing and has such a tremendous level of detail to tell us.
And plus, you know, took care of all of those bureaucratic filings. We'll hear all about it directly from him just after the break.
Karen, we have our first international guest joining us from Italy, so we hope people won't mind the sound quality, but welcome, Carlo.
Hi.
How are you today?
Well, I'm a little bit hot, but fine. This is as always, but things are going ahead.
We're excited in part because you're the first guest we've had that's Well, actually, you're our first international guest, and we're really excited to talk to you about some of the work that you've been doing, you know, in the European Union, especially about the Microsoft antitrust case. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about your practice?
My practice? Well, I must say that I have always been involved in technology in my career, but only recently, since 2000, more or less, I've been involved in free software advocacy and advising clients on this. So it came natural when the Microsoft decision, the decision that the Commission issued against Microsoft was made public, and Microsoft declared to want to file an appeal to contact Free Software Foundation and ask, what do you mean to do with this case? Are you planning to say something to produce some evidence and stuff? And they say, oh, yes, we definitely do. And by the way, we need a lawyer. And so I turned into an antitrust lawyer as well, apparently. So this is how things I got involved with the case. But since then, I started working more closely with Free Software Foundation Europe, and I became their general counsel. So now I'm very much involved also in free software licensing and in all sort of advocacy issues. And I've been involved also in standardization and anti-software patent activity. And I give lectures, speeches, and stuff against all those threats to digital freedom.
So I think what our listeners are going to be most interested in is the antitrust case. And I think particularly in the U.S., but even some of the folks I know in Europe don't understand completely how the antitrust case against Microsoft worked, how it came to be, and what the free software community got out of it. So can you tell us, go through in detail how the case came to be and what the end result for the free software world was?
Okay, if you have a couple of days, I can give you a very full account of every single detail of the case. Actually, the case takes four or five square meters in my shelves.
Okay, but, what can you do in 15 minutes?
Okay, let's browse through it. Actually, the U.S. and the European cases are somewhat similar and somewhat related. The main difference is that the U.S. Investigation and resulting measures have been largely ineffective, while the European ones have been widely successful and are starting to be effective. This is the main difference, which makes a lot of difference, of course. It all started with a very ancient complaint by Sun Microsystems. you know, that Microsoft initially wasn't that dominant in the workgroup server market. So they had this Windows operating system, but in the market of operating network operating system, Novell was the quote dominant unquote company, and Microsoft was striving to impose Windows as a network platform. So they were supportive in interoperability, especially towards Unixes, because of course Unix was the legacy big computers. And so they provided a level of interoperability support very high. Then when the situation changed and Microsoft started to have the upper hand, they decided that the new coming operating system, Windows 2000, wasn't necessary for it to be that interoperable, and it stopped offering Sun Microsystem the previous level of support. So Sun complained that this was disruptive to their interoperability efforts, and they complained with the European Commission. It took 5 years for the European Commission to finalize a decision against Sun Microsystem, and meanwhile another topic arose, which is that relating to Windows Media and the tying of Windows Media into Windows. But only in late 2003, a hearing was held in Brussels, and only in early 2004, the Commission was able to issue a final decision covering both cases, the first pertaining to interoperability, and the second concerning the time between Windows and Windows Media Player. For what we are concerned, mainly the interoperability case imposed on Microsoft to release not source code, not to open up their entire crown jewels, but to share, to offer timely and complete interoperability information so that potential licensees could use them to produce independent and interoperable solution that could be could work as a plug-in replacement to the Windows operating system. And of course the free software had one of the best solution to this effect, which was Samba, and Samba was the natural national client for this offer. Unfortunately, the decision allowed Microsoft to request licensing conditions under reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, which means that Microsoft was requested to offer licensing conditions pretty much in the same vein as the partnership program they offer within the decision of the U.S. DOJ. So this was also a wide branch of litigation after which we might talk later. But Microsoft wasn't very pleased of the outcome, and they challenged the decision on many grounds. They claimed that the decision was forcing Microsoft to release very secret and very important information that was that were produced with a lot of investment, and that could give a free ride to their competitors to produce an alternative to their products without having done the same kind of hard work. And basically, they claimed that the Commission was helping the losers, the ones who could not compete on the market, and they had to resort to the antitrust remedies. They claimed that the information were not necessary because there were other ways to achieve the same sufficient degree of interoperability. And for instance, they said that people could use different layers of software. They could implement the standards that also were implemented in Windows. And one of the defense was that reverse engineering was an efficient way to achieve interoperability. And interestingly, Stammer was cited as quite a good success story for this reverse engineering, because you know that Stammer had produced their product by network analysis alone, without much help from Microsoft. But of course, this is quite a lame excuse, because of course, Stammer, for how successful they can be, they only implement quite ancient set of the Microsoft protocol. Another defense that Microsoft was very clear in bringing forward was that all the computer in a network, in a Microsoft network, or in a Windows network, are tightly coupled. So they work as if they were a single machine. So anything that tried to replace one piece of this network, of this tightly integrated, had to be very intimately communicating with the rest of the network, and these could jeopardize the security of the network, because they had to actually strengthen the protocols, harden the protocols, because they were not anymore in control of all the parts of the network, and this was something that made us jump when we heard that that notion, because that is that amounts that the way they achieve security is not by hardening protocols, but through obfuscation of the details of the communication.
So the court rejected those defenses?
The court rejected entirely those defenses because we regard those defenses as an ex post facto justification of a clear anti-competitive behavior, and we think that those excuses are what they are, excuses, that are not sufficient to give them a free ride on the market, just to achieve monopolization and to abuse the market.
So what did the decision that officially that came down? What did the decision finally say, and how is it how does it benefit free software?
Okay, well, the decision almost entirely upheld both commission's cases, both on the interoperability and on the Windows Media Time. So all the defenses of Microsoft have been rejected, including that their quote intellectual property unquote could not be trumped by the antitrust. Actually, the Microsoft case tells us anything, is that quote intellectual property unquote does not trump antitrust rules, and antitrust rule can force a company to release some of their patent, copyright, trade secret. This free software can benefit and actually benefit from this decision, because after 10 years during which Microsoft refused to release any information on their implementation of what basically are publicly available protocols just embraced and extended, we were able, thanks also to the help of Professor Eben Moglen, we were able to negotiate, lastly, licensing conditions compatible with the GNU GPL. You remember that I mentioned earlier that Microsoft was allowed to set their own interoperability licensing conditions, or to propose them, and so that a negotiation could be opened. And these reasonable and non-discriminatory, in our stance, require that those conditions were compatible with free software. And what Microsoft proposed was actually against, openly against the free software condition. For instance, they requested to account for each and any copy sold. After the case has been upheld, in the full case, Microsoft basically decided not to pursue this strategy anymore, and we came up with an agreement that upon which, after a payment of $10,000, all the information was released to the Samba team through the Protocol Freedom Information Foundation, which is an entity we built on purpose. And the information can be implemented and used to produce free software, fully commented free software. And if this license were to expire at some point, all the developers that wrote software upon those information could bring that development forward without any rollback or any negative effect to the code that has been produced. And I'm reported that many free software projects made use of this information because they're actually a useful source of specification as to the Windows protocols. So, but unfortunately, this doesn't cover patents. Patent rights claimed by Microsoft are outside the agreement, so we are seeking actively to change the situation and demand that also some protection extensible to the whole free software market is granted by Microsoft, because we believe that unless this situation is achieved, there is always some risk that one day or the other somebody knocks at our doors.
So what do you think, how do you think things go next? What do you think we need to be focused on against Microsoft in Europe, and how do we move forward, and what are the biggest challenges?
Well, pretty much the work group situation has been addressed, apart from the software patent issue. And which, by the way, calls for activism against any proposal to enhance the ability to obtain software patents in Europe and worldwide. For the rest, of course, Microsoft has been able to increase their market share and their dominance over many parts of the market. Their market share in client and server operating system have been kept steady and have been consistently more than 95% on the client. So there are many more threats that we have to be afraid from. One of the most recent activities by the Commission is the service of a statement of objection on Microsoft, suggesting that they are abusing the market by tying the browser Internet Explorer into Windows, and there is currently a pending decision which is expected from the Commission anytime soon, and we have been active and vocal as Free Software Foundation Europe to make sure that the Commission goes all the way through also in this field. And moreover, there are pending investigations against Microsoft for abuses very similar to these, to the interoperability case, for instance, in the multimedia in the SharePoint and SilverLight technologies, and also in, of course, in the what we call personal productivity applications like Microsoft Office. There are very high expectation that sooner or later the Commission will start tackling also those areas.
Yeah, what do you think the next move or issue is with regards to the standards related to Office? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on the OOXML ODF issue as well.
Oh, that is also a very complicated matter. Basically, we're trying to put these OOXML case on the table, because we see clearly that this is also an attempt to reinforce the dominant position in the application market, especially in the word processor market and spreadsheet and stuff. We try to fight against the approval of the XML implementation of Microsoft proprietary format as a standard, because we think that the standard is completely a different thing, and moreover, because a standard already existed for the same domain of application, namely ODF, and so duplicating a standard was clearly an attempt to proprietarize a sector which is the open standard sector. Because you know that also in Europe as well as in some states, and namely Massachusetts, and, the public administration demanded that the application use open standard. But OOXML was not, from our point of view, an open standard, because open standard must be neutral, must be independent from the platform, should be democratically achieved through consensus between various independent developers. All these things were not respected in the OOXML case. But by sheer force, by convincing national bodies, and sometimes in indulging in very questionable activity at the national body, unfortunately, Microsoft was able to break into the standard process and to sort of abuse it through rubber stamping, through a fast-track procedure, a standard which was clearly immature, and so immature that Microsoft itself is not implementing it into its product, and is not going to implement it for a couple of years more. So, but with OOXML now, they're able to claim that they also have a competing open standard for office productivity application. But this at least caused a delay in the adoption of the already mature and implemented standard, namely ODF. And this is clearly, because it's made by the dominant company, this is, to us, is clearly an antitrust violation.
I think the OOXML stuff is fascinating. One of the things that I was sort of thinking about might be interesting to our listeners, that I was thinking about while you were talking about that, is in both the standard situations and also in the two Microsoft cases, I think people would be interested in hearing and how you're actually involved with this, since the cases are between the Commission and Microsoft, how is it that that you get involved?
Well, luckily, very early in the process, third parties which are interested can intervene and have a say and be heard by the Commission at the administrative level. You know, that before issuing a decision, the Commission conduct a very serious procedure which involves hearing the parties, which involves the issuance of a statement of objection. An independent officer is nominated. A hearing can be held. It's a quasi-trial. And even at this part, the latest part after the statement of objection is issued, an interested third party, as the Free Software Foundation Europe, is admitted to this process and to submit pleadings and to be part in the oral hearing. This is what we have done in those cases, and even in the most recent browser case. And when this decision is challenged in court, is appealed in the court of instance, and ultimately in the European Court of Justice, which is the highest authority in the judicial system in Europe, you can request to be admitted as an intervening third party, and if you show to have a direct and immediate interest in the outcome of the case, this is what we have done. So we have been admitted in a couple of cases now, and we participated also in the written pleadings and in the oral hearing. And I must say that in the oral hearing, the Samba team people, and especially Andrew Trigil and Jeremy Ellison, also for Kalandake, were incredibly helpful and convincing, almost compelling. So I must say that the contribution of the Samba team and of the free software in general have been very important. And also the other parties and the other parties' lawyers have been very, very clear about the importance of having those very prepared and very accurate people and very convincing people showing up actually in court and testifying the genuinity of our claim. This was incredibly useful.
I think it's a huge success that you were able to to get Samba and the Free Software Foundation involved. I think that's actually a big triumph.
Yeah, and in fact, I go further to say that you're in many ways a hero of free software in a very non-traditional sense. It's really easy to get people to write free software, but to get someone like yourself who's willing to deal with the complex bureaucracies of the European Commission and of the way Microsoft's trying to manipulate the bureaucracies in Europe to and the standards bodies to hurt free software. Somebody like yourself who's willing to put up with that thing that I think no computer programmer wants to do, generally speaking, that you're doing it for us and having great successes. I just want to thank you for doing all that work on behalf of the free software community.
Well, I've been the lucky man to be in the right time in the right place, and I enjoy being the spotlight. Many people work behind the scene without the glory of being praised as you say, a hero, and I'm barely avoiding laughing after this, but those people deserve the highest praises because they've wonderful job they have done, the huge amount of time they have dedicated, the passion and attention and competence they brought to the case, without which I could have done almost nothing. I've been a facilitator. I've been connected the wires, but all the energy was provided by these people. I thank them very, very much, and I share any glory, if the glory is there, with them.
Yeah, you sound just like a free software project leader saying that that it's a team effort and it takes a community to make things happen, and that's very in the spirit of free software.
Yeah, I regard myself as free software project leader and legal hacker as well.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for joining us. I'm glad our listeners get a chance to see the work that you're doing. It's not often heard about in the U.S., and I hope lots of people enjoy hearing about this excellent work that you're doing. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, so thank you for having me.
I think Carlo actually is a hero. I think you're right. I think he's too modest.
Well, you know my belief that the most important people doing free software stuff are the people that are doing things no one else wants to do. And listening to all this work that he had to do and all these arguments that Microsoft made back to him and how he had to answer each one and ultimately get a good result for free software after a tremendous amount of effort.
Yeah. Plus, we got to see some of the, we see some of the the real hardcore bureaucracy that he had to deal with, the paperwork he had to file just to even be heard.
Yeah, and that's somebody willing to do that. It's a heroic act for free software, I agree, because it's not many people that are willing to put up with that level for the sake of free software. You know, lots of people want to write code because that's fun, but
I don't want to sell him short anyway, because a lot of the work he did was very high level too. Mm-hmm. So it's not that he's just doing the administrative bureaucratic stuff, although that's in part what makes him a hero. It's also the
And the strategy is important, too. I think that he really came to this case with a good strategy that obviously worked, because we got such a good result for free software developers who were able to better compete in Europe and around the world against Microsoft. And so that type of... But to come up with a strategy is one thing, but to come up with a strategy and implement the bureaucratic details to make that strategy work, I mean, that's the cart as well as the horse.
He's worked with others as well.
Of course, he reminded us it's a team effort indeed, but the team leader in free software is always too modest for the work that they do, and I think Carlo is as leading this team that's responded to the issues of antitrust Microsoft stuff in Europe is quite a leader to have done all this, and hopefully our guests can get a sense of our listeners can get a sense of how complicated this is and how difficult it is. I hope people are able to follow all that. And certainly if you have questions about what Carlo was talking about, email them in. Mm-hmm. But it really gives you a sense of how much you have to know about and pay attention to answer the kind of things Microsoft's doing. They have a lot of power and ability to crush free software in a variety of different ways. You know, we remember the old days when they just used PR mechanisms to do it, but now they're using every trick in the book, including buying off ISO, as we know, to get OXML through, which Carlo talked a little bit about, and using the antitrust system in the EU and the US to basically get off scot-free in many cases.
But what's so great is that software is such an international enterprise right now that the positive decision in the EU has positive effects in the US and elsewhere. So that's something that's quite neat, is that even though the US case didn't really came of that, we have directly been benefiting from the EU case. So that's something that's actually quite interesting. And a little bit different.
Well, and it's different because of the way free software works. Because free software is such an international effort compared to, you say that when you said the software industry is international, I don't actually think it's true. I think the free software industry is. The free software world is very international.
I'm biased towards the free software industry.
as am I. But I think the piece that Microsoft didn't understand as they probably celebrated their victory in fighting the U.S. case was that, as you point out, a case in the EU that settles the wrong way for them or gets resolved the wrong way for them means that the free software community can compete in the U.S. just as well as Europe.
Yep, and the Protocol Freedom Information Foundation that Carlo mentioned is actually a U.S. entity. Mm-hmm. So that's what's contracted.
That we helped set up. So it's hopefully in future shows we can go into more detail about how that system works and how basically we made use of this thing, because that's the next step. Once you get that kind of success, you have to make use of the ruling in a way that really helps free software move forward. And my hope is that in the next show we can get into details about how that's actually happening.
You always have these great wrap up sentences, and then I want to just say, yep, we'll see you next time. And that was one of them. So, yep, maybe see you next time.
And podcast at softwarefreedom.org if you want to email questions.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of halfbakedmedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Why do you make me record these fake outtakes?
It's like our signature now. We have to do it every single show.
Isn't that a little OCD?
You'll thank me later.